But verse 60, though rarely rendering help to others, I blow my trumpet loudly. Though unwilling to accept risks, I gloat with ambitions. Dance and trample on the head of this betrayer, false conception. Mortally strike at the heart of this butcher, the enemy, the self. Okay, so remember here, Dharma Rakshita is pointing out a lot of our bad habits and how our self-grasping ignorance and self-centered thoughts sabotage our wish for happiness. So specifically, he's here saying, though rarely rendering help to others, I blow my trumpet loudly. Okay, so rarely doing a lot, we talk a lot about how much we're going to do. And we talk a lot about how much we've done, you know, but the actual fact of what we've done is very little. So this relates a little bit to the conversation from yesterday and today, is I learned that I hear a lot of people with great sincerity say all the things that they want to do and all the help they want to give and what they're going to do. And but I've learned to wait and see what they actually do, you know, because it's by doing what we say we're going to do that we really, we come to have credibility, because it's very easy to talk, but much harder to do. And sometimes, you know, it's not just our own laziness or distraction or self-centeredness. Sometimes there are external circumstances like illness or visa problems or whatever that prevent us from fulfilling our aspirations. But, you know, this whole thing of blowing our trumpet loudly before we're going to do something, promising a lot but actually delivering very little, or afterwards doing something small but then claiming all the credit for ourselves, you know, even though somebody else was the one who did most of the work, we claim the credit. Or, you know, we did a little bit, but we tell everybody we did a lot. Or we made a lot of boo-boos, but we say we did a wonderful job. You know, so, you know, just bragging and boasting and, claiming the praise for ourselves, though actually our actions were insignificant and didn't match what we say we did or don't match what we say we're going to do. Okay, so it's a difficulty of arrogance and pride. Okay, so we don't do a whole lot, but we're very filled with conceit about how much we've done. Yeah, and you meet people like this. You know, it's like people fill out a resume for a job, and it looks like they're Buddha on their job resume. You know, all these great qualities. They've done this and they've done that. Looks fantastic. And then you call for some references and it's like, who? Oh yeah, you know, they were around for a few weeks. Okay, so this is this line is teaching us to be a little bit more accurate about our self-evaluation and a little bit more humble. That doesn't mean that we hide what we've done. Okay, we can talk about our good qualities and accomplishments, but without embellishing them and without boasting of them. In other words, we talk about them when it's necessary, but not when it's not necessary. Okay, so for example, I mean, some people take this to the extreme, and, you know, somebody needs help with something. They have the ability to help, but they say, well, I won't say it. They think I won't say anything because then everybody will think I'm arrogant if I say I can do that. Well, that's not right either. Okay, that's going to the extreme of keeping our qualities hidden. So we need some kind of balance here where, you know, our qualities are known and we volunteer for what we can do, but we don't embellish or promise things we can't deliver on. And then the second line, though unwilling to accept risks, I bloat with ambition. So, you know, though unwilling to really do anything, we have a whole lot of ambition for what to do. And again, you know, you meet people like this who, they're full of ideas, you know, they're just idea factories. They come up with so many ideas and so many projects they want to do and so much ambition. But then they get stuck and they can't do anything with it. They just sit there and, you know, either they're lost in their heads coming up with more ideas and they're tired of these ideas, so they jump to more ideas and don't carry out the first set. Or, you know, they get distracted by something else or they get discouraged. But, you know, they have tons of ambition but actually don't do a lot and aren't willing to risk anything to accomplish their aims. Okay, so, although we lack a good reputation, we hunger for it, we have great ambition for a good reputation, but we don't do much to get it. And then we boast to others about how great we are, thinking that that will get us the reputation that we want. So you can see that this verse is very much about arrogance and, you know, a very selfish ambition. Yeah. Now, somebody once asked me, do Buddhists have ambition? Yeah, because sometimes people get the idea, oh, well, you know, here's like this verse, you know, I bloat with ambition. Okay, well, all ambition is bad, so I just don't have any ambition at all. And anyway, you're supposed to stay in the present moment, not think about the future, so I just won't think about any of that. Well, you know, it's so easy when we hear the words of the Buddhist teachings to misinterpret what they mean. Okay? And so, for example, this whole thing about not living in the future and not living in the past, it doesn't mean that you never think about the future and the past. Okay? Instead, what it means is that you don't get distracted with fantasies, you know, of attachment or anger, selfish fantasies about the past and future. It doesn't mean that you never think of them. Because we have to look at our past and see how it's conditioned us so we can change the conditioning, so we can purify past mistakes. We have to think of the future so that we have a plan and an idea. I mean, what's the Bodhisattva vow about? It's thinking about the future. It's promising what we're going to do in the future. What's the determination to be free of cyclic existence about? It's thinking about the future, and we want to get out of cyclic existence. So it's not that we're never supposed to think about the past and the future. What that saying in the Dharma is about is not to get distracted with, you know, attachments from the past and attachments to the future, or not to get distracted with resentments and grudges from the past and ideas of revenge in the future. That's what it means. So when somebody asks me, you know, does that mean that you know, do Buddhists have ambition? I said, yes, we have ambition. We have ambition to be out of cyclic existence. Okay? We have the ambition to, you know, to attain enlightenment, to be able to benefit other beings. Now, that doesn't mean having a selfish ambition, because clearly to accumulate these kinds of goals, you know, we can't be ruthless. We often associate being ruthless with being ambitious. But I guess, you know, there's different kinds of ruthlessness. And I guess you can have a certain kind of ruthlessness in pursuing the path to enlightenment, in the sense that, you know, all the internal obstacles, you're not going to pamper them and cater to them. You're ruthless at banishing them. Okay? So we can have, you know, ambitions, but they're virtuous ambitions. Okay, and we can be very clear and very straight and ruthless, but we're ruthless with our self-centered attitude and with our afflictions. Okay. So it's important to understand these things properly, otherwise we generate a lot of misconceptions. Okay, so in this kind of verse, you know, especially this thing about, you know, we boast about how much we've done, but we've rarely done a little bit. That's completely opposite to the Bodhisattva vow. Because the Bodhisattva vow, I mean, we're vowing to become Buddhas for the benefit of sentient beings. Okay? So, I mean, we've made a pretty heavy-duty promise there. And it's not one that you go back on once you've made, because you've promised it to every single living being, and you've promised it in the presence of the Buddhas and Bodhisattvas. So you can't say afterwards, sorry, I've changed my mind. You know, and that's why it's, you know, people really have to think well before they take the Bodhisattva vow. Because to back out on that kind of vow, you know, it just, it's not very good, you know, to break our promise to one person is one thing, but to break a promise to each and every of the infinite number of sentient beings is a whole other ballgame. Okay? So, oops, I made hiccups. So when we help somebody, rather than be bloated with pride about what we've done, to just say, well, this is actually the least I could do because I promised to lead them to enlightenment. Yeah? So here I am, you know, I'm carrying a box for somebody, or I'm doing a favor for somebody, or I'm taking care of somebody who's sick. It's the least I can do considering that I vowed to attain enlightenment for their benefit. So there's nothing here to get all arrogant and proud about. Okay, we can still feel good about what we've done, and we should rejoice in our own virtues. But rejoicing in them and being arrogant about them are two different things. Okay, so we have to distinguish these kinds of things. Otherwise, we really go to one extreme or the other when we practice. Okay? So I think that's one nice thing about having the Bodhisattva vows. You know, we've already thought well about how we want to interact with sentient beings, and we, you know, we've thought well about their kindness, and we know we want to do what we're capable of to benefit them. So then when an opportunity arises to benefit, we just do it. We don't have to sit there and, you know, hem and haw and give in to our fears and things like that. Now, of course, if somebody asks us to do something we don't have the capability of doing, then we explain that to them because it's not fair to tell them we're going to do something we're not capable of. Or if we don't have the time because of prior commitments, then again, we shouldn't volunteer. We should be honest with people. But what I'm talking about here is when we do have the time, when we do have the ability, rather than give in to our fears or our self-concern, the Bodhisattva vow just enables us to go forward with it. And people ask me about that when they find out that I do prison work, you know, because I don't look like this big, strong, tough person who could defend myself very well against a bunch of hardened criminals. And I don't view the guys that I work with as hardened criminals, not at all. They're human beings, just like the rest of us. But it's like, well, when I got these letters, I had taken the Bodhisattva vow, so I respond. Here's people asking for help. I don't sit and think, oh, well, you know, I'm not very strong, and what could happen to me, and na, 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 and what are people going to think, and you know, it's like, here's somebody who's earnest, who's asking for help. I help. I don't have a choice, you know. Of course, if it's somebody who's not earnest, if I get a letter from somebody, and in all the time I've been doing this, I've only gotten one letter where I felt uncomfortable with what the person said, you know, but if I get that kind of letter, then I just, you know, I have compassion for the person and I don't respond. But, you know, and that's because I didn't feel that they were coming from a sincere place. But if somebody's coming from a sincere place, then we do what we can. Yeah. Okay, so when we see that we're blowing our trumpet loudly or bloated with ambition, though not coming through on things, then what do? Dance and trample on the head of this betrayer false conception. So the self-centered thought, the self-grasping ignorance. Mortally strike at the heart of this butcher, the enemy, the self. So recognizing that the real enemies are inside. And how do we mortally strike at their heart? By realizing emptiness and by generating bodhicitta. Okay, so those two are our primary A-bombs that we drop on the enemy, okay? So the compassion side of the path, the wisdom side of the path, those are our virtuous weapons of mass destruction, okay? Because they destroy the, you know, the edifice of the self-centeredness and the self-grasping ignorance. We have our non-virtuous weapons of mass destruction, which sometimes are more numerous and our arsenal more well-stocked and ready to, send them out. But that arsenal we have to, you know, the arms inspector of mindfulness and introspective alertness are going to come and find those weapons of mass destruction and then use our wisdom and compassion to destroy them. And then wisdom and compassion become our weapons of mass destruction against the actual enemy. Okay. I'd love to teach this in the White House. You have problems finding weapons of mass destruction? Look inside. You know? Because we do. Yeah. You know, when all this whole talk about was going on when the war first started, you know, oh, we're going to find those weapons of mass destruction. I was teaching at that time. I had just come out of retreat. And I was telling you, you know, we have our own internal weapons of mass destruction, you know? How things that we do, nasty things we do to people we don't like, that just devastate them. You know, these are the ones that we have to rein in. Okay, then the next verse, 61. Though having many teachers, I have little capacity to observe the precepts. Though having many students, I have little patience and scant wish to help. Dance and trample on the head of this betrayer, false conception. Mortally strike at the heart of this butcher, the enemy, the self. So this verse deals with our relationships with our teachers and our relationships with our students. Okay? So though having many teachers or preceptors, I have little capacity to observe the precepts. Okay, so we run and we're very happy to take precepts, take the five precepts, take the bodhisattva precepts, take the tantric precepts, take tantric commitments. We're very happy to take them, but we don't have much capacity or energy to observe them. Yeah, so we break them all the time, and then we go back to our teacher and we renew them, and we come out and we break them again. So this verse is not saying that we have to be perfect and never break them, but it's reminding us that, you know, we made a promise, and these are important things to put some effort into, to not be glib about our vows and commitments and our precepts, you know. Because sometimes people just, you know, oh yeah, I took them, and then, you know, they just kind of forget about it, you know. Whereas our vows and commitments, whether it's the pratimoksha ones, bodhisattva ones, or tantric ones, all these are the root of all of our future progress on the path. Because, you know, our ethical discipline is the foundation for everything that comes. And if we can't get our ethical discipline together, how in the world are we going to gain higher realizations? You know? Because you meet these people who, you know, they love going to teachings about Dzogchen and Mahamudra, but then when you say to them, you know, stop lying or stop drinking, they go, what? Don't tell me what to do. I'm going to live my life the way I want to. You know, my drinking and my lying have nothing to do with my spiritual practice. That's my private life. Well, actually, if you study the Dharma better, you would understand that they have a lot to do with your spiritual practice. Yeah, that those things are the basis of our spiritual practice. So somebody once asked me, can you say the essence of the Dharma, you know? This whole thing about, you know, what was it? Somebody asked one rabbi about saying the essence of God's teaching while standing on one foot, and it was, what was it, love thy neighbor as thyself, something like that. The essence of Buddha's teaching standing on one foot is, you know, abandon, you know, the negative and do what you can to help and purify your mind. And that those three are the essence of the Buddha's teachings. So somebody asked me for a modern version of it, and I said one line, stop being a jerk. But stop being a jerk has very profound teaching behind it, because there's many levels of being a jerk. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So there's, you know, there's being a jerk in not in you know, being attached to the happiness of this life, and not keeping just our regular precepts of not, you know, abandoning stealing, lying, or bisexual behavior. Mm-hmm. You know, toxicants and killing, right. Okay? So that there's that level of being a jerk, yeah, that we want to overcome by, you know, developing an aspiration for a good future life and by getting our daily life act together and being a kind, you know, keeping some kind of fundamental ethical discipline. Second level of being a jerk is liking samsara and thinking samsara is great. You know, that's really being a jerk. And so, you know, to overcome that, then we generate the determination to be free by contemplating the Four Noble Truths. And then we practice the pratimoksha precepts to attain liberation. And, you know, meditate on the three higher trainings, you know, higher trainings about the ethical discipline, concentration and wisdom to get ourselves out of cyclic existence. And the third level of being a jerk is thinking that our own spiritual liberation is much more important than anybody else's and clinging on to that in a very self-centered way. And so to counteract that, we do all the bodhicitta meditations, we take the bodhisattva vow, we take the tantra vow, and we engage in the practice of the six far-reaching attitudes, the four ways of assembling students, and the tantric path. Okay? So stop being a jerk is very profound if we really understand it. Yeah? Okay. But what this verse is talking about here is, you know, though we have a lot of teachers, we have very little capacity to observe the precepts or to follow our teacher's instructions. So, you know, you meet some people who have lots of teachers, but they aren't committed to any of them. It's like, they'll go to teachings here, go to teachings there, go to teachings there, but when their teachers ask them to do something, they're out of there. Yeah? It's like they're on to the next place. So their teacher may ask them, you know, to do a certain practice, but, you know, they don't want to do it, so, you know, they don't follow the teacher's instruction, or their teacher may ask them for personal assistance, you know, in projects or doing something, but the people, you know, they got all the teachings, well, ciao, I'm out of there, you know. So they don't have any real commitment to following, you know, to repaying the kindness of the teacher, to following the instructions, the Dharma instructions that they've received. So that kind of leads them to a dead end. Okay? Okay, so they say that it's better to, I mean, some people have a lot of teachers, some people just have a few teachers. And it's perfectly fine in Buddhism to have more than one teacher. We may have one or two that kind of are our root teachers that, you know, are the ones that were the first ones who really touched our hearts and that we principally rely on. But we see all of our teachers with respect and try and follow their instructions as much as we can. So they always say that if we don't have the capacity to have good relationships with our teachers, then it's better to have fewer teachers but very strong faith in those teachers. Whereas for other people who have a greater capacity, then they can have more teachers and still maintain that strong faith towards each and every one of their teachers. So it's kind of up to us. Lama Atisha had, I think, 147 gurus, you know? But, I mean, he was quite wise, and he could, you know, have a good relationship with all of them. Some of us, you know, who have a difficulty with that, and, you know, we find ourselves just, you know, kind of, you know, oh, give me the teachings, but, you know, leave me alone when you say something that bugs me. Then, with that, it's better not to have that kind of attitude towards too many people. It's better then to really work on developing strong faith and a deep commitment and feeling of connection with fewer teachers. And I think that feeling of connection with our teacher is really something quite important. And it doesn't always depend on being physically close to the teacher. It depends on being close in our own heart. You know, because when we receive teachings, you know, when the teachings go in our heart, that's the, you know, our teacher being in our heart. And that's why, like when you do the practices, you visualize Tenrezi on the, you know, outside, and you think of Tenrezi and your teacher being of the same nature, and then when you dissolve Tenrezi at the inside and emerges with your heart, you think of unifying your mind with your teacher's mind. And that doesn't mean unifying your mind with your teacher's personality. It means with their spiritual realizations. And so, you know, really feeling the presence of the teachings that our teacher has taught us in our own heart as our own understandings grow and as we slowly progress on the path to gaining realizations. Okay, so it's not a thing of always being physically close, but being mentally close. And I remember one time seeing Lama Yeshe, this was in Dharamsala, and Song Rinpoche was also one of my teachers, but he was there, he's one of Lama Yeshe's teachers, and he was sitting there, and Lama, I don't know what they were talking about, but Lama was kind of kneeling beside him, and I just have this image of, you know, just how close they were as student and disciple, and I thought, well, what is it that makes them close? It's the fact that they both cherish bodhicitta, you know, that their minds are unified in having that altruistic intention for enlightenment for all sentient beings. And that one, that's what makes them, you know, a close student and disciple. Okay? So that they also say that we should, when we're choosing teachers, we should choose teachers who care for us spiritually, and if you're a monastic, who also help us materially if we're a new student. And a teacher who will warn us when we're doing something that's not very wise or that is non-virtuous. And if, I remember the teacher who was saying this was Geshe Nalandargi, and he was really tough. You know, he didn't pamper us. But, you know, he would explain things like this and when he taught us that, you know, having a teacher who will correct us when we're about to make a mistake or when we have made a mistake, that kind of teacher is very precious. It's more precious than a teacher who just pats us on the back and says, you're so good, you're so wonderful, you're the best student I have, I'm so glad you're around, na 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 na, you're so sweet, na 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 na. You know, because that kind of, you know, then our ego just kind of goes bananas, doesn't it? But, you know, a teacher who will say, oh, you look a little bit angry, or, you know, remember the discipline that we're trying to follow, or, you know, just kind of, you know, remind us of things, that teacher is very, very kind. And, you know, it brings us up against this instinct that we have to kind of, you know, be instantly defensive when somebody says something that we take as advice. Ooh, I told you this. I remember one time, Geshe Jumpa Tekchuk was, he wrote me a letter, and it was when I was starting to work on the Abbey, and he mentioned something in there. I hadn't asked for advice or anything like that, but he just mentioned something in there about being very, very careful about the eight worldly concerns. And, you know, at first I said, uh-oh, why is he saying this? Is, you know, have I been blowing it? Is this why he's bringing this up? And then, you know, I thought about it, and I realized, I mean, this is tremendous kindness of his, just to warn me, because this is the thing that is the downfall for so many people. You know, what Helen Ann was saying, what she sees around the Christian ministers, you know, what is it? It's intoxicant sex and wealth, you know, money. And that's the eight worldly dharmas right there. And so, I mean, all Geshe was doing was just saying, remember this, this is something important. And so when I realized, you know, it wasn't like he was accusing me, it wasn't anything, it was just his compassion, you know, reminding me, you know, even though I knew that, it's, you know, the fact that he reminded me is really stuck in my mind, you can see, because I'm telling you the story. Yeah. So, you know, and when I went to see him last year, oh, I was such a dodo. We were sitting and talking, and it was after breakfast, and he was talking, and he was emphasizing to me, you know, that in leading the monastery, really focus on the big things. Don't, you know, harp on the little ones. Yeah, but really focus on the big things. Take care of those. And right after he said that, I said, oh, and do you have any advice for me? And Steve, the translator, looked at me and said, I think he just gave you some. I mean, I'm dense sometimes. So, and then I thought, oh, yeah, that's really true. But, I mean, look, I've remembered it. And I've seen in the last month, you know, as things happen around the Abbey, I remember that advice, you know, focus on the important things and not on the things that, you know, are lesser important. Yeah. Of course, you guys think I think everything is important. But I'm restraining myself, you know. I mean, I was very good. I was about to, now I'm just giving you an example, but I was about to comment on let's not cut the poppies because they don't do well when they're cut. They fade in a few hours. But I restrain myself because I remember that isn't very important, you know, that the poppies are going to fade anyway, whether they're cut or not.
I didn't know that, though.
What?
I didn't know you could help me.
Okay.
Nancy helped me.
Nancy told you that?
Yeah.
Oh, okay. Okay. Okay, so that's about the line, though, having many teachers, I have little capacity to observe the precepts. The second line is, though having many students, I have little patience and scant wish to help. Okay? So this is, you know, the person who immediately wants to elevate themselves to the position of a teacher, you know, or is qualified and elevates himself, you know, and is elevated to that position. But they don't have little patience with their students or very much interest in really helping them along the path, the Dharma path. So that's a big problem because the student relationship is a very special one and there's commitments on both sides, you know. And if a teacher takes somebody as their student, you don't just kind of use the student for what they can give you and then, you know, throw them out in the garbage in the same way that the students don't use the teacher for what they can get and throw them out the window. But, you know, but it's really a very important spiritual connection and commitment that's involved there. So it's kind of, you know, here a warning that if we want to take students, that first of all, we should really have a great deal of patience with them, you know, and we should have a genuine wish to be a benefit to them, be a benefit to them. Now, why do we need patience with students? Well, I can say from the side of being a student because sometimes I'm obnoxious to my teachers, okay? And so a teacher needs to be very patient because the students blow it a lot, you know, and their minds are unruly and their minds are untamed. If you get completely fed up and angry with them, you know, then they're going to lose faith and they're going to, you know, lose the capacity to hang around. You won't be able to benefit them. So you need to have a great deal of patience. Also because if every time a student makes a mistake, you know, you get wigged out, your own mind's going to be pretty unhappy. Yeah, so you really need a great deal of patience. And you need a very sincere wish to help. And that means that, you know, students will call you at all hours of the day and night. They will, you know, come, you know, interrupt you when you're doing things. They will come to you sobbing. And you have to have a wish to help. Yeah. And, you know, what I see in the West sometimes is like, you know, people who are very eager to become teachers. You know, and I think I've probably mentioned this before, that when somebody tells me they want to be a monastic so that they can teach the Dharma, I'm very suspicious. Because that sounds like career, you know, they're looking for a career. And although it's wonderful to teach the Dharma, we should become monastics because we want to practice the Dharma, because if you don't practice, you can't teach. Yeah? And we're always students, we're just sometimes in the position of being a teacher, but we're always students. Okay, and being a teacher is just a role you're in certain circumstances, but always, you know, being a practitioner. You know, so some people kind of have this ambition of, you know, they want to be a teacher, and you know, they want to take ordination because it gives them some kind of legitimacy, you know, because they think, oh, if I'm a monk or a nun, the people will respect me more, and then they think, oh, I've taken vows, now I can be a teacher. And they're junior monks and nuns, and they need to train, you know, but they're already thinking of themselves as very special and, you know, bossing the lay people around or whatever. I read something, or one Theravada friend told me that most of the disharmony in monasteries is caused by junior monastics thinking that they're already arhats. You know? And you find this sometimes, you know, people at the beginning just, you know, great ambition. Oh, yeah, now I'm ordained. Now, you know, I'm this great teacher, and I'll tell everybody how it is, and now they'll respect me, and they'll treat me well, and they should make offerings to me. And now you even see lay people wanting this. Oh, I'll be a teacher, and then people at the Dharma Center will see me as special. They'll listen to me. You know, they'll praise me. They'll appreciate me. You know, and it becomes all twisted up with one's own emotional needs, you know, for recognition and honor and respect. And it can really be poison, because sometimes what these people do then is they start seeing themselves as teachers, you know, when they're not qualified, so they don't give good advice to people. Or even they give good advice because they've heard a lot of teachings. They close themselves off and don't look at their own mind and their own practice because they're so busy being a teacher to somebody else. And you know, they're not realizing that being a quote-unquote teacher is distracting them from looking at their own mind. And so then a lot of other stuff can happen that becomes poison in their own mind that they're not aware of, because, you know, they're just going along with the old mechanisms. Okay. And that's why if one is teaching, it's very important to be under the guidance of our own teachers and to maintain our own relationship with our teachers very strongly. Because it's our teachers who are going to correct us, or it's our teachers who are going to teach us. And, you know, we always go to our teacher in a role of humility. You know? So I see people sometimes, and especially lay people, I mean, well, monastics too, but I see it more with some of the lay people becoming teachers, and they're not really studying with a teacher themselves, you know. Or I suggest to them that they do more retreat, you know, so that they have retreat, and, you know, or they go to more teachings, and they'll say, well, you know, I just took a group of, you know, 40 of the students at my center to hear teachings by, you know, so-and-so Rinpoche. But you see, when you take your group of 40 students to hear teachings, you're still in the role of being a teacher. You know? You're never out of that role. And you're still a leader, you're still a teacher, so it's still very possible that you just, you know, you may act humbly to your own teacher, but you're still very busy taking care of everybody else, thinking that now I'm a teacher, and not looking at one's own mind. Or sometimes I suggest to people they do more retreat, because Lama Yeshe was very clear with us, you know, that we should do at least a month of retreat every year, you know, and especially if you're teaching, at least a month of retreat. And retreat doesn't mean a Dharma course. Retreat means meditation, where you're really meditating, not where you're receiving teachings, you know, part of the time, or having a course. So Lama, you know, really recommended that to us. But I see these people, you know, teaching and then saying, well, I can't go to retreat because everybody's relying on me and everybody's depending on me in the center. What will fall apart if I'm not here to lead it? And I think that's a very dangerous attitude, because our primary obligation is to be a Dharma practitioner, you know. And if everything's going to fall apart then because we aren't there, then the whole structure of the Dharma Center is rotten, okay? Because a Dharma Center should be able to sustain itself at least for a month with all the people coming together to talk about the Dharma and meditating on their own. In any case, I don't think that many centers will really fall apart if the teacher's not there for a month. You know, we aren't so important that if we go away for a while, everything's going to totally disintegrate. Some things may disintegrate, but then we come back and, you know, we put it together. But it's not going to be some major thing. And if we've trained the students well, you know, not much is going to fall away, and things might actually get better when we're not there because the students will become more responsible, you know, instead of relying on us to do everything. So I try and tell people this kind of thing, but then they feel there's some kind of sense of self-importance that, you know, oh, I've got to be there, you know. Or I'll take my 40 students and we'll all do retreat together, but that's not a retreat. You know, you have to be doing your own retreat where you're not the leader sitting in the same room with everybody else, you know. That's really important. You know, so I think some people think, oh, you know, if I'm a teacher, I'll be a leader, respect, people will listen to me. But they don't realize how actually difficult it is, you know, you really have to have a tremendous amount of patience and a great wish to help. Mm-hmm. Yeah, because, you know, people come and people go, and you have to be okay with that. And people come and people will criticize you, and you have to learn to be okay with that too. And, you know, students come and they do all sorts of things, and you have to learn to be okay with that. And it's, I mean, it really pushes you to practice more. But many people don't really understand that, and they're, you know, because they're too focused on being a teacher instead of being a practitioner. So that's when I think a lot of these difficulties, you know, happen. So, yeah, so that's this verse is important, you know, because whether, you know, we're talking about our relationship with our teachers, which all of us have, or whether we're talking about our relationship with our students, or even with new people who come to the Dharma Center, new people come to the Abbey, you know, to always have this sense of humility and a real genuine wish to care for them, and not try and, you know, be the powerful person in the Dharma Center and the powerful person who runs everything. You know, we take responsibility, but being responsible is very different than abusing power. Okay, and we have to be able to discriminate these things, you know, and not go to the extreme of avoiding responsibility because we think that, you know, we'll just be on a power trip if we take responsibility. You know, they're different, and we have to see the difference in our own minds. Okay, then verse 62. Though eager in making promises, I am weak in actual help. Though my fame is great, when examined, even the gods and ghosts are appalled. So, dance and trample on the head of this betrayer, false conception. Mortally strike at the heart of this butcher, the enemy, the self. Okay, so this emphasizes some of the previous points. Though eager in making promises, I am weak in actual practice, practical help. Okay, so again, you know, promising but not coming through. Yeah, and then, though my fame is great, when examined, even the gods and ghosts are appalled. Okay, so somebody might have great fame, you know. Somebody might have a big title. Like His Holiness the Dalai Lama, he's always warning the Rinpoches who are incarnates, you know, who got the title Rinpoche because they're recognized as an incarnation of a great master, you know, the previous life of a great master. He's always warning them, you know, don't just coast along depending on the glory of your past life and the title you got this life because of it, but really practice earnestly so that you deserve the position that you've been given. You know, he always says this, and he will scold the Rinpoches right in front of everybody. I mean, I've heard him do that. And it's very good advice. So what he's saying is if you have a title, instead of seeing it as something to, like, put on airs about and expect favors from others about, see it as something to live up to. You know, if you have a title, oh, okay, I have to try and live up to this title. Okay. So though my fame is great when examined, even the gods and ghosts are appalled. So we might be very famous. You know, maybe we've written a lot of books. We go on world tours, you know, 10 million students and, you know, radio interviews and TV appearances and blah, blah, blah. So great fame. But our behavior is so awful that even the gods and the ghosts can't stand it, you know. So even the demons are like horrified by how we behave. It's so bad. You know, and why are they appalled? Because we don't live up to what we teach. Okay, we teach one thing, but our own actions are something else. So we tell everybody else, you know, don't steal, don't lie, don't cheat, but then what do we go out? We go and do it. You know, we do hanky-panky with the finances in the Dharma Center. We go, you know, have extra, you know, have affairs with students, you know, go out and do all sorts of who knows what, okay? So we don't live up to what we teach. And then our thoughts, which even other people can't see, but we know our own thoughts. Our thoughts sometimes are pretty repulsive, you know, kind of, you know, you're teaching people and then your mind's going off on all sorts of, you know, self-concerned things about how you can milk the people for all they can, you know, all you can get from them, or, you know. And that's, those kind of thoughts are repulsive even to the demons. Yeah, Dharma Rakshita does not pull any punches here, you know. He doesn't let us off the hook. Okay, so just to be aware of this, and then again, this is, you know, really a call to, you know, to be wise in the promises we make and to come through, you know, in terms of practical help. And if we have a reputation to see it, a good reputation to see it as something to live up to, not something to take for granted, and to make sure that we try and make our behavior conform as much as possible to what we're teaching to others, or, you know, even for an older student and helping the newcomers, that you know, that what we're instructing them in, that we try and do it ourselves. And this is hard, you know, because, you know, it's so easy for the mind to make up so many excuses. You know, so it's really something to be vigilant about. Okay. Yeah, because especially sometimes after we've been practicing a while, we think, oh, well, okay, I've been practicing a while, and I have a certain kind of reputation among my Dharma friends, so I can just, you know, relax a little bit now, and I don't have to be so strict with myself as before. And I can go to the movies, and I can do this and that. Yeah, you know. So, you know, it's not a thing of squeezing ourselves. I mean, Lama Yeshe has talked a lot about not squeezing ourselves, not pushing ourselves. But it's a thing of really understanding what causes happiness and what causes suffering, and then to be vigilant about creating the causes for happiness and abandoning the causes of suffering. Why? Because we want to be happy and we don't want to have pain. And we don't want to cause pain and misery to others. We want to be able to bring them happiness. And so we you know, try and live our values because of that. Okay. Then verse 63. Though weak in learning, my temerity for empty words is great. Or my penchant. That's another translation. I like better. Though weak in learning, my penchant for empty words is great. Though slight in scriptural knowledge, I meddle in all kinds of topics. Dance and trample on the head of this betrayer of false conception. Mortally strike at the heart of this butcher, the enemy himself. Okay? So the weak in learning, my penchant for empty words is great. Okay, so So we haven't spent time studying the scriptures. Yeah? And, you know, and this is another error that sometimes people make, is we misunderstand things. You know, it's so important to have a balanced view. Like, we'll read Milarepa's autobiography, and Milarepa sometimes, he was scathing to some of these geshis and scholars in how he criticized them for just being puffed up with a bunch of words and not practicing anything. And he just kept on saying, you know, stop thinking so much and stop studying so much and do some practice. And that's very wise advice because he was giving it to people who had studied a lot and who needed to practice. But we newcomers come and we read that story and we think, oh, Milarepa's saying that study is not very important and that we shouldn't study, we should only practice. Well, that's not what Milarepa was saying. He was talking to a very specific group of people, these geshis who had studied a lot and needed to practice. He wasn't talking to us who don't know anything and so don't know even how to practice. The geshis knew how to practice, they just weren't doing it. We don't know how to practice. So in all of the Buddhist traditions, some level of study is very important. You know, and sometimes, and I say this because sometimes people come in and they say, well, I just want to meditate. I don't want to study. Well, how are you going to know how to meditate if you don't study? Because meditation doesn't mean you just sit down and cross your legs and close your eyes and, you know, and go like this. You know, that's what your body is doing. You have no clue what to do with your mind if you don't study. And I remember when I was first exploring spiritual things, you know, I went to some Hindu ashram or something, and you know, we'd go in there and everybody would meditate. There was no meditation instruction. I had no idea what to do. So my mind was just going completely bonkers and I'd get up and leave. Mm-hmm. You know, and I remember the first Dhamma course I went to before I had any instruction, the very first night when the lamas were supposed to come, they were late. And so, you know, Nick and Wongma were saying, well, let's just sit and meditate. I had no idea what to do. You know, so I kind of went like this and rolled my eyeballs back because I saw a picture of somebody doing that one day, you know. Hurt my eyes. You know, I had no idea what to do. So it's very important to learn how to meditate so that when we meditate properly. Because, you know, you hear, you know, now all sorts of people are using the word meditate, you know. And what they mean, basically, is, you know, positive affirmations and daydreaming. You know, imagine yourself, you know, for somebody who lacks self-confidence but wants to, you know, get a very good job. Imagine yourself being, you know, tall and good-looking and, you know, or gorgeous and, you know, being very powerful and very well-spoken so that you, when you walk in for your job interview, you know, you just come across as terribly, you know, confident and capable, you know. And they lead somebody in a meditation about that. And they call that meditation, you know. Or for somebody else who lacks confidence, imagine, you know, that you ask somebody out on a date and, you know, and you're very charming and you're witty and you self-express yourself very well. You know, and then imagine how that person, you know, instantly is attracted to you. You know, and they lead people in these quote-unquote meditations. Well, that's not meditation. You know, that's enhancing our attachment. That's daydreaming. Okay? So it's very important, especially nowadays, you know, in the spiritual supermarket to really do some study. Yeah? So what this line is saying, the weak in learning, okay, so we haven't studied much. Our penchant for empty words is great. So we haven't studied, okay? We think we can go and meditate. And when we talk to other people, we just say all these, you know, we throw around all these words that we've heard, but we don't have any understanding of them, okay? So, and you see this, you know, especially with people who jump to the highest teachings and people hear all this vocabulary, I mean, you know, because it's full of vocabulary, you know. The bliss and emptiness, you know, or access the mind of clear light, or realize emptiness with direct perception, or generate the impartial mind of bodhicitta. And we hear all these words, but we don't really know their definitions because we haven't studied enough. We don't really know how to practice. But we're very eager to become what I call the Chai Shop Guru. Chai is tea, you know, the tea shop guru. In India, you know, everybody goes sits in the tea shop. So likewise, you know, we're happy to hang out with people and just repeat all these very highfalutin words, you know, just relax in the vast, open, spacious nature of the uncontrived mind. Even I can say it. It sounds great, doesn't it? I have no idea what those words mean, you know. Okay, you can read this kind of stuff, and the words sound great, and they sound inspiring, and they, ooh, you know, and we can have this penchant for all these fantastic words, but what in the world is an uncontrived mind? And what does rest in the vast, empty, spacious nature of the mind mean? How in the world do you do this? When your mind's full of worrying about how to pay the mortgage and worrying about if your kid is going to pass first grade and wondering, you know, what you're going to do with, you know, your neighbor who is, you know, beating his wife. And, you know, when your mind's full of that kind of thought, what in the world does, you know, rest in the vast, spacious nature of the uncontrived mind mean? You know, or people talk about, you know, just sit and feel the spontaneous bliss and let us focus on emptiness. What in the world is spontaneous bliss? Does anybody have any clue what that is? You know, or the immutable bliss. You know, people go to Kala Chakra and they come back. Oh, I've understood the immutable bliss. What in the world is the immutable bliss? You know, they think they get turned on sexually and that's the immutable bliss. Sorry, you know, it's something else. Buddha means something else. So, you know, this is like a real big warning to us to, first of all, in our own practice, not get infatuated with all these highfalutin things, but really study well so that we know what the terms mean. And second of all, you know, not to try and become the chai shop guru and just, you know, spout all these empty words that we have no conception what they mean, but they sound great. Yeah? Okay? And so then, you know, even if you're in the role of being a teacher, a student asks you a question, you have no idea how to answer it. So what do? You say, well, all you have to do is realize emptiness, and that cuts the root of all afflictions. Yeah, it's true, but you have no idea how to lead the student on how to realize emptiness because you don't have a clue what things are empty of. Okay. So if we've really studied well, then we're never short of proper answers to give to people who ask us good questions. You know, but if we haven't studied well, then we just get caught up in all this empty kind of stuff. Okay? So then the second line says, though slight in scriptural knowledge, I meddle in all kinds of topics. Okay? So we've never, like, gone through a text and studied it from beginning all the way to the end. We've never stuck through and, you know, got through it. But we meddle a little bit here, you know. We study a little bit this one. We study that one a little bit. We study this one and we study that. And then we read all kinds of things. You know, we read Hindu things, we read Christian things, and Sufi things, and Jewish things, and, you know, all the vocabulary of all these different theories. But everything's completely empty, you know. We haven't really studied anything seriously, and so our scriptural knowledge is very weak. But we, you know, we meddle in all, you know, we know a jack of all trades, yeah, kind of in spiritual theory, yeah. So our study's very haphazard, and yet we think we're experts. Or, you know, I mean, it's just so easy to misunderstand things. I was reading something last night where a Zen master was saying that, you know, because you always hear in Zen, stop thinking, stop your thoughts, you know? So people who just hear that, stop your thoughts, stop thinking, think that you're supposed to sit there with a blank mind. And then they can do years of blank-minded meditation. You don't get any realization. But you might be able to concentrate your mind, but you've banished all the thoughts. And this Zen master was explaining that stop thinking That's not what it means. It means stop the mind of distraction that's wandering to the past and our past pleasures and our past failures and wanting to the future and our hopes for future pleasure and our fear of future failings and wandering to this and that and playing and dabbling. That's what stop thinking means. Okay, stop the worry and the anxiety and the attachment. You know, it doesn't mean stop thinking altogether. But, you know, we hear a little bit of words and we misunderstand it. We do wrong kind of meditation. Okay? So, this is the disadvantage of meddling in all kinds of topics. You know, I mean, we can be great masters when everybody sits around after lunch and talks about things. Because we've studied crystals and we've studied holistic healing and we've studied this and we've studied... None of it do we know very well, but we can spout off a lot. Okay? So what this verse is it's warning us against all of that. Because then we actually, you know, although deep in our heart what we want is liberation and enlightenment, our mind gets distracted from the path by this kind of thing. So it's better to like really stay and, you know, whatever level of study we want to do or are capable of doing, do that. You know, don't bite off more than we can do. Don't go to the high studies if they don't mean anything to us, you know, because we always have to build a foundation. But whatever level we're at, stick with it, you know, and not just kind of dabble or you know, get enthralled with all these great words that you hear